Our next case is 11-212, State of Ohio versus Wesley Lloyd. For the appellant, Mr. Hardwick.
May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor, Mr. Warner, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. When deciding how Ohio's sex offender and registration statute treats out-of-state offenses, this court should apply a strict elemental test for three reasons. First, because the words of Ohio statute requires it. Second, it's what other states with identical statutes have done. And also because of the severe penalties that can attach missing a sex offender deadline by even 1 day. The lower court said here they found it to be a strict liability offense and imposed a 3-year prison term for a first-degree felony. In this case, for one of the cases, missed the deadline by 7 days. Under 2950.01, a sexually oriented offense from another state is an offense that is substantially equivalent to any one of Ohio's sex offenses. And I think this case is the best illustrate this difference, what this means, substantially equivalent, and the difficulty with the state's case are in the state's brief, and those are the 10th District cases, the Core and Miller cases. Because in those cases, although they apply the wrong standard, they do get some things right. They do provide an example of statutes that say different things but mean the same thing in the end. In both those cases, they found that they were statutory rape cases, and they looked at Ohio statute had espousal, not a spouse requirement, or the out-of-state didn't. But the 10th District correctly noted that in both states, it is legally impossible for a 12-year-old to get married. And therefore, that element will always exist in the other state. That is not a substantial difference because there is no such thing as a 12-year-old married person. And I think the 10th District case also illustrates the flaw in their argument, because the 10th District's core case cites a Texas statute and says, well, we don't have to get these things exactly the same, or they don't have to mean the same thing. They just have to ban the same conduct. Well, as that court noted but apparently didn't notice, the Texas statute doesn't require substantial equivalence. It requires only that the two statutes be substantially similar. And I'll concede that Ohio's rape statute is the most similar statute in Ohio to the Texas statute, but it is not substantially equivalent because the mens rea of the Texas statute is knowing, where our mens rea is purposeful.
What did he do in Texas?
He was convicted of, we don't know anything of the facts other than that the victim was his wife, was his common law wife at the time. Nothing about the facts of it introduced. We know that the statute requires that he knowingly penetrated under threat of force, and that that's what the statute required. We know that the indictment required knowing and intentional. We know that the jurisdiction said knowing or intentional, and that the jury verdict said convicted as in the indictment. And I think one thing that's important is this. As in all other states, we look only at the elements, because if we don't, first of all, that's what the other states do, and that's what the statute requires. But if we don't, we start.
Do we have an equivalent statute for theirs?
Well, under Ohio, it drops all the way down to menacing in Ohio.
And what does menacing require as a mens rea?
It's knowingly.
So you can knowingly rape someone in Texas, and it's a different statute than purposely raping somebody in Ohio, which is only, in your opinion, a menacing.
Correct. Well, it would be assuming that the prosecutors came into court and proved that this person knowingly penetrated another person under threat of force.
How do you not knowingly do that?
Well, this court said
I can see it maybe in an assault, but in a rape, how do you not knowing? How is their knowing any different than purposeful when you look at the elements of a rape?
Well, first of all, this court expressly and clearly said that there was a difference in the Wilkins case, which is cited in my brief. And the example this court gave is that you could not intend to rape someone without their consent, but the circumstances could be such that you would know that they weren't consenting, that you weren't trying to go over the consent, but you knew that you would have known that they consent, that there was a lack of consent. Given the circumstances around, you should have known that there was a lack. That's what this court held in the Wilkins case. The court was very clear on that. And again, unless this court would effectively have to overrule Wilkins, I believe, to come to that
point. Well, counsel, are you concentrating on the fact that the spousal criteria is not present in Texas and it is present in Ohio, and that's the big deviation here?
No, that's for the rape statute that doesn't apply because there is no spousal requirement for forcible rape in Ohio. But that's why it can't be GSI, why it can't be any of the other lower offense, sexual battery, because all the lower sexual offenses in Ohio require that the victim be not the spouse.
Not the spouse, but rape doesn't have that.
Forcible rape doesn't. There is another part of the rape statute that has a spousal, has a not the spouse requirement. And part of the reason why we want to look at these elements, because if we don't, again, other states require them. That's what the statute requires. But if we don't, we create all sorts of problems. And I've shown a Texas authority that shows that when you look, that we presume that the Texas jury followed their instructions. Therefore, if we look beyond the indictment, we should assume that they followed the jury instructions saying knowing or intentional. But this puts us in the problem, this court in the problem of interpreting the nitty-gritty of Texas criminal procedure. And the state would have us decide, well, does the indictment control over the jury instructions? Does a verdict that refer to the first indictment control over the over the jury instructions? Does that control over the statute? And that's those are things that Ohio courts are not well equipped to decide.
So, counsel, are you asking us then to look at the two statutes side by side in the abstract?
Correct.
That's what you're.
Correct, and yes, and if we want to get into the facts, there, if we're required to get into the facts, then the state also loses because they presented no facts as to what happened in Texas. And again, another problem with looking going beyond the abstract statute is we have to have a mini trial about what happened in Texas in 1994, 1995. Witnesses are in Texas. Investigators might have to be sent to Texas. It would be a very complicated affair for the Auglaize County Common Pleas Court. In fact, actually, the problem is this actually even goes back to the sheriff trying to figure out what do I register this person in the first place. That sheriff would then have to figure out what happened back there. If there's a dispute, a court would have to figure out that. And also moving on to another reason we should do this is this is a criminal statute, and this court has traditionally held and has always held that criminal statutes must be strictly construed against the state and liberally construed in favor of the defendant. And if there's any doubt in the statute, Mr. Lloyd gets the benefit of that. Also looking at 2950.99, that statute in some ways is even clearer because that's the punishment statute. What I've been talking about first is about what even makes you eligible to fall into our...
Counsel, my understanding from reading the materials is that he did report. He was adjudicated or he was designated as a sexual offender, and he did report in Auglaize County. Is that correct?
Using the active voice support here, the sheriff designated him as a sexually oriented offender, and he did register, and I'm arguing in here that he didn't have to.
Okay. Did the sheriff go out and find him in Auglaize County and said, you need to register, or did he contact Auglaize County when he moved from Texas with the paperwork from Texas and said, looks like I have to register here in Ohio?
Well, I think he said he wasn't sure, and as a matter of caution, he did register, and also I think this shows the injustice of and the improperness of a 3-year prison term for missing a debt after years of.
Did he have to register and report in Texas?
There's arguments both ways. He said he didn't. The state says he did, and I don't believe the record actually resolves that.
But he moved to Holmes County after he had registered in Auglaize County. Isn't that the fact?
Correct. And he moved there, and he says in this trial court... No.
And sort of on his own, after having registered in Auglaize and reported, he sort of decided, I'm done with that. Now I'm in Holmes County, and he didn't report. Isn't that mm-hmm. how we get here?
No, because when he called... He says he'd notified the Auglaize County Sheriff in advance. They say they didn't receive the notice. But the day he moved to Holmes County, he called the Auglaize County Sheriff and said, I'm here in Holmes County. The Auglaize County Sheriff told him something that was just dead wrong. The Auglaize County Sheriff's deputy, and the deputy concedes this on the stand, told him, you cannot register in Holmes County until you personally drive back to Auglaize County and tell me in person what you just told me on the phone. And that's just a completely wrong and improper. And for that, he gets a 3-year, one of his convictions leading to a 3-year concurrent prison term.
Well, the question I have is, did he register in Holmes County or did he not?
He did. He was arrested. He did not register. He was arrested 7 days after the registration deadline. He was found in the house where he told the sheriff's department he would be. And he registered very quickly once he got out of jail after being arrested for this offense.
But like you said, one day or a year later, it's strict liability.
That's the issue. All the lower courts, this court has never addressed that issue, but the lower court held that it was strict liability. And I would, in the future case, I'm sure that issue will come back before the court. The 29-50, it is also possible this court rejects the argument on the first point that if we get to the punishment statute, that the wrong level of felony was applied, because the punishment statutes ask what would the offense have constituted if committed in Ohio? And under the Pelfrey case, if someone was convicted of knowingly sexual penetration with force, they'd be convicted of either menacing or aggravated menicing, both of which are misdemeanors. And under Ohio law, failure to register when you're for an offense is a misdemeanor, is a fourth-degree felony as opposed to a first-degree felony. Again, coming back to strict interpretation, strictly construed against the state and liberally in favor of the defense, that shows that he's at most liable for a fourth-degree felony. Finally, this court might find that there was a gap in the statute if this court finds it some oddity in the statute, but this court has repeatedly said in other cases that when there are gaps in the sexual offender statute, this court's not going to fix them. In fact, three members of the court expressly used that term in the concurring opinion to the unanimous decision of State versus Taylor. Heil versus Porter, this court refused to apply a statute retroactively. And as Brewer, this court said that if someone leaves prison before they have a predator hearing, they never have to register.
What was the determination of the Court of Appeals here, Mr. Hardwick?
There were many issues in the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals rejected Mr. Lloyd's recklessness argument. They did throw out one of his three offenses, failure to notify Holmes County 20 days in advance, because that was a requirement only of Tier 3 offenders, not of sexually oriented offenders under Megan's law.
But on the issue that's before us, how did the Court of Appeals adjudicate its?
It's similar enough, and there wasn't a lot of analysis. Basically, I think they used the most similar approach. And I guess, again, I can see this is most similar to rape, but it's not substantially equivalent to rape.
And so you're asking us really to compare crimes in other states to determine if they're substantially equivalent to Ohio crime.
Actually, if the offenses is enumerated in the statute. We don't look at the actual crime, what occurred, but the offenses, yes.
And so potentially for offenders who relocate to our state, we could go through this and compare our rape statute to all 50 states potentially, and then we move to felonious assault or...
Right. And I also think that would be, yes, but that would be a lot easier to do that on an elemental test than it would be on a fact-based test. And this is a lot easier to do that. And if the General Assembly wants to adopt the Texas-style statute of substantially similar, they can do so. But the General Assembly did not choose the same language as Texas. They chose a substantially equivalent law.
So you think the language of substantial equivalence is dissimilar enough from substantially similar as to create this issue?
Correct. And yes, in the states that apply substantial equivalence say that it's only substantially equivalent if they use the same words to different words to describe the same conduct. Like one state said that its statute prohibiting unfit driving was substantially similar to another state that prohibited drunk driving. They say, look, anytime you're drunk, you're unfit, and therefore the drunk behavior covers our statute. New Jersey said its child abuse statute was substantially similar to the federal traveling with a child with intent to commit harm, because anytime you violated the federal statute, you violated the state statute as well. Those are the kind of things that would be substantially equivalent. And knowing is not substantially equivalent to purposeful. In one of the problems with the conduct test that the lower court, the 10th district has applied, is the crimes are composed of two elements, mens rea and actus reus. And the 10th District and the lower court below only looked at the actus reus. The mens rea is important or it wouldn't be there. Our General Assembly is...
But doesn't the Texas say intentionally?
Intentionally or knowingly.
A person intentionally or knowingly causes, the act of rape without the person's consent and places the victim in fear of serious bodily injury or death will be inflicted during the course of conduct. And that, you say, is not equivalent to the forcible rape in Ohio.
Right, because under the Pelfrey case, if an Ohio jury found that someone intentionally and knowingly did everything that was in the Texas statute, they would not be guilty of rape, because you are not guilty of rape unless you act purposefully. And when we don't know which element is decided, which one they decided on, we go to the lower one. That's what the Pelfrey decision says. If we don't know how much was stolen.
Does Texas have any statute on rape that uses the word purposely, or does theirs all use intentionally?
Intentionally is there, and I can see intentionally is equivalent to purposely. They use intentionally where we use purposefully. And that's one place it would be substantially equivalent using different words. If Ohio's rape statute said intentionally and it said purposefully, that would be substantially equivalent to intentionally, because I can't come up, there's no difference between those two. That's saying the same thing with different words. In fact, that's basic first year criminal law. 1L criminal law would say that.
Mm-hmm. But here, by including the term or knowingly, that takes it out of the substantially equivalent.
Correct, because because it's basically purposefully or knowingly, and if you purposely or knowingly did something, that's what the jury found, you're only guilty of knowingly doing it, because the jury must find the higher offense in Ohio, and if they didn't find the higher offense, you're not guilty of it, and you can't be convicted of it. Thank you.
Mr. Warner?
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the Court. My name is Sean Warner. I'm Assistant Prosecuting Attorney for Holmes County. I'm representing the state of Ohio here today. The defendant appellant, Wesley Lloyd, raped his ex-wife by using a stun gun in Texas in 1995. In Texas, they don't call that rape. As we do in Ohio, they call it aggravated sexual assault, as correctly identified by opposing counsel.
Was she his ex-wife at the time he did that?
That is ambiguous, Your Honor. He stated that they had gotten a divorce, but in his mind they had a common law marriage. Texas does recognize common law marriages at the time, but he didn't state in detail what the requirements were, how long.
If you're a common law marriage state, you can have a divorce, can you not?
I'm sorry?
You can still get divorced even though you had a common law marriage.
Correct.
So what was his status at the time of the crime?
They were divorced, Your Honor. They had never remarried.
Yeah. At the time he committed the offense in Texas?
Correct. In January of 1995.
Okay.
And the state submits that distinction, the wife or not a wife, is not so applicable in this case because, as opposing counsel correctly stated, even in Ohio you cannot forcibly compel your wife to have sex with you. That's still rape. The fact that there's force involved in both statutes negates the wife question, at least that's the state's position, because when you purposely compel by force in Ohio under subsection 2, 290702, It no longer matters whether the person is your wife or not at that point. And because force is not in Texas.
I thought he argued if this statute isn't a perfect fit, then when you start dropping down the other offenses, it does matter.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as a GSI, gross sexual imposition, and some other related offenses in Ohio, it does require that the victim not be the spouse. You are correct.
And that's how we get down to the menacing equivalent, is that,
right.
You've got to be you can't be a spouse, and you go through that test, and you end up with, I guess, the least common denominator that happens to be menacing.
Right. That is Mr. Lloyd's contention.
Okay. So then if it would matter whether he was or wasn't married or whether they were divorced.
Correct. If you make the initial
determination. When the original offense occurred.
Correct, Your Honor. If you make the initial determination that it's not equivalent to rape, which we submit that it is. I agree that the state is not interested in retrying old cases. We don't want to go back to.
But I thought his brief said was his wife, and yours says wasn't when that offense occurred.
Actually, I don't think in the brief that I don't recall addressing the wife's status.
Well, you say on page 5. Or he was sentenced to 7 years. He was convicted against his the first sentence. He was convicted on December 8, 1995 in the District Court of Taylor, Texas, aggravated assault, sexual assault against his former wife.
Correct. I was speaking as to the divorce.
So when you say that, she's now his former wife, but you're not saying she was his former wife in 95. You're saying you don't know.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying they had a divorce. I'm not familiar with how common law marriage works.
All the way to the Supreme Court, and they're, he's making an argument that if this doesn't match up, then you do go down the checklist, and if, in fact, she was his wife at the time, you end up with a misdemeanor.
Well, again, Your Honor, that's only if.
So it's pretty important, isn't it? Arguably.
It is important, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that it wasn't important. I'm just saying in the state's position, it's equivalent to rape because of the force element.
I understand that, but you're also saying the state doesn't know whether he was or wasn't married?
Right, because the only evidence we have, Your Honor, is his testimony that he had a common law marriage. He didn't say how long that they had been divorced or if they were living together or any of that. He just said in his mind he had a common law marriage. And checking the statutes, they do recognize common law marriage. I don't know if all of those elements were met. I'm sorry, it's not in the trial record. That's what I'm meant to convey. Apologize for any confusion. Looking at what the state submits is the substantial equivalent offense, which is rape in Ohio. If you forcibly penetrate someone, if you without their consent, if you use force to secure that submission, and if you threat imminent bodily harm, under those circumstances, you could do that 7, 8, 9 times in Texas and be convicted, and then come to Ohio and you don't have to register because of the question of whether the jury found intentionally or knowingly.
His argument seems to hinge on it could be intentional or knowing, but the indictment says intentionally and knowingly, and then the jury verdict says, we the jury, having found the defendant guilty of aggravated assault, as found in the indictment. So the jury references back to the indictment, which is an and you only can get to his position, as I see it, if you accept an or argument, because he concedes intentionally is the same as purposely.
Correct, Your Honor. That is our primary contention, that this particular fact pattern is not a good case to.
So there's no. Is there any evidence at all that the jury verdict was decided on an or basis?
No, Your Honor, other than that Lloyd contends that the jury charge was or. However, just because the jury was instructed that they only had to find knowingly and that they could find intentionally, you know, four distinct possibilities come to mind right now. The jury could have found that they only did it knowingly and stated that. They could have found that he, in fact, did it intentionally and stated that.
But the verdict says, yeah, as charged in the indictment, and the indictment uses an and.
Correct. They chose to refer to the indictment, which says intentionally and knowingly. So we have the judgment entry of conviction. We don't have the underlying facts of the case, as Mr. Hardwick correctly pointed out. All we have to go on is the court's pleadings. And in the judgment entry of conviction, the language quoted is, we find him guilty of this first-degree felony as indicted. And the indictment clearly stated intentionally and knowingly. And that was brought out at the appellate level and cited throughout. Taking that into consideration and taking Mr. Hardwick's advice, we don't want to guess at what was proven or not proven at trial. What we do have is the pleadings. The court speaks through its written orders, and the only written order we have gives us a finding of intentionally, which defendant already concedes is the same as Ohio purposely.
In the opening part of Mr. Hardwick's brief, he contends that, in fact, he wasn't required to register at all. Was there here, and is there any process for making a determination, any judicial process, or does the sheriff just get to make that decision and then it sticks throughout, or was there an opportunity?
There was no hearing, Your Honor. However, Lloyd himself testified when questioned by his own counsel that he established his duty in Texas before he came to Ohio and then proceeded to the Auglaize County Sheriff's Office. So it was, and there was communication between Texas and the Auglaize County Sheriff's Office. So it was the law enforcement personnel that determined he was a sexually oriented offender based on his conviction.
And he did have paperwork from Texas.
Correct.
That he brought with him and presented it in Auglaize County. But I'm here to meet my obligations.
Yes, at pages 104 and 105 of the trial transcript, he clearly says he took the affirmative steps to establish his duty there and then to register here. And he references the forms that he had to get from Texas and bring to Ohio and give to the Auglaize County Sheriff's Office. And again, that was on direct testimony. So
he claims, if I understood Mr. Hardwick's argument, that he advised the Auglaize sheriff of his relocation to Holmes County and gave him the address where he was.
Correct, Your Honor, after he was already in Holmes County. But
yes.
He missed his deadline by 20 days. He was supposed to notify Auglaize County in writing of his intention to move there.
And
he had just registered 14 days prior to his move and never mentioned
and
it.
He argues, if I understood Mr. Hardwick, that your client was unable to register in Holmes County because of having failed to give notice to the Auglaize sheriff. Could you comment about that?
His client, he contended that a deputy from Auglaize County stated that he had to come back and register with Auglaize before his registration could be transferred to Holmes County. And that was the testimony of the officer. And that is how...
Is that the law?
That is in the administrative code, Your Honor. It's how the ESORN process is administered.
So a defendant who relocates to another county cannot register with the sheriff in the new county?
He can notify the sheriff, but he's required under ESORN. That's why you're supposed to give the 20 days advance notice so that they can transfer what they call ownership.
Was the Holmes County sheriff ever notified of Mr. Lloyd's presence in Holmes County?
Yes, but not by Mr. Lloyd. The Auglaize County Sheriff's Office contacted Holmes County sometime within the next few days after Wesley Lloyd contacted the Auglaize County Sheriff's Office. A detective from Auglaize County went out to his prior residence, saw that there was no one there, then called the Holmes County Sheriff, advised Mr. Lloyd was living there.
Did the defendant, in your view, have an obligation to report to the Holmes County Sheriff?
In each one of his registration forms where he was required to register for the 3 years that he did in Auglaize County, his requirements are stated on the form and in bold letters the possible penalties for failure to comply, which he signed. If it was me in the same position, knowing that I was not in compliance, I would want to let the sheriff's office know that I was there. He didn't do that. In fact, he did nothing. He made no effort to return to Auglaize County or to notify Holmes County for 10 days after his move before he was arrested in Holmes County. He was arrested on June 14th. That very day, he suddenly had the means to go down to Auglaize County and register. Why he couldn't have done that in the prior 10 days, it's not clear. He never testified to that, what his difficulty was at the time.
Does he have a car?
He used the car to move to Holmes County. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Have a job.
I'm not sure at the time of his move. I know he has one now because they've mentioned that in his briefs. But at the time that he moved from Auglaize County to Holmes County, I don't believe that he had a job upon arrival. But he didn't testify to that in the transcript.
Counsel, what is the policy in Holmes County? If he was, in fact, required to personally present himself in Auglaize County, but is now in Holmes County and didn't really understand that until he got to Holmes County, and he instead notified the Holmes County Sheriff's, I'm here, things didn't work out right, but I'm here. What is the policy about charging someone with a violation of the statute under those circumstances?
Well, I don't want to speak entirely for the Sheriff's Office because I hadn't had that conversation with him, but had he presented himself to the Holmes County Sheriff's Office and said, I'm here, I screwed up, I forgot to register there, then, speaking from the prosecutor's office, when it's on my desk, if he made the affirmative steps, I wouldn't be charging him with what was count three, the failure to notify within 3 days, because he'd made that effort. Even if he couldn't have been technically transferred under the ESORN system, under the statute, he would have been in compliance had he made any effort in those 3 days to contact Holmes County. Now, if Auglaize County wanted to pursue charges because he had still missed that 20-day deadline, that'd be up to them. However, he would have gotten himself off the hook for count three. And count two has been dismissed by the Fifth District because of the ruling in Bodike. It was based on a tier three classification.
Where's Mr. Lloyd today?
Where's Mr. Lloyd? In Holmes County, outside of...
Pardon me, please?
In Holmes County, outside of Glenmont.
And where does he reside?
His address?
Yeah. He's at his home today.
Correct.
Okay. And is he
not the same address? He's moved from there, but
he reporting to the Holmes County Sheriff?
Correct. Yeah. He is in the sexual offender registry for Holmes County.
Okay.
Yes, he is compliant now. However, as mentioned before, Mr. Hardwick was noting that this is a criminal statute which requires strict liability. Well, when upholding the sexual offender registration scheme, this court has found that it is in fact constitutional, partly because it's not punitive. It's a public protection statute designed, that's the reason it's strict liability. The government has a paramount interest in protecting the safety of its citizens, and that's what this statute is about. This isn't, he's facing criminal penalties now because he's failed to register. Again, the statute says substantial equivalence of an out-of-state offense to an in-state offense to be considered a sexually oriented offense for registering.
Well, counsel, we really wouldn't be here arguing about substantial similarity or equivalency on the rape issue had your office not charged him with the failure to register and the consequences. Correct?
Correct.
And he was, although not probably in the most efficient way, but he was attempting to, you know, register. He may not have followed the letter of the registration code, but you knew where he was. The sheriff in Auglaize County knew what his address was in Holmes County. Whether he crossed the T's and dotted the I's is a different question. But are there ever situations where the prosecutor chooses not to indict someone who is maybe less than accurate in the technical parts of this registration?
I'm sure there are, Your Honor. In fact, I think I addressed one by Justice Krupp's question. Had Mr. Lloyd made any effort in the 3 days after he'd been to Holmes County, then he wouldn't be facing that particular count of the indictment. However, again, he was required to submit 20 days advance notice. He just registered 14 days prior to moving. He never mentioned any intent to move.
Maybe he didn't know at the time.
Perhaps he didn't, but there's also a statutory mechanism to comply with that. It requires, once you know of the move, which he testified in trial, he knew prior to the day of the move, he knew approximately 12 days in advance that he was going to move. He never called Auglaize County then. He didn't call them in advance,
but
as he's required to do.
He did call them and let
after
them
he'd already
know
violated the statute.
On the same day that he was moving, right?
After he was there, yeah. Not sure. I think the red light's on.
Yeah, you're over your time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hardwick, you've saved a little over a minute.
I'd like to start with to contradict something the state said, that this is a remedial statute, therefore we shouldn't apply liberal construction. In State versus Williams, the 2007 Williams, this court said that, yes, this is a remedial statute, generally, but once you cross the line into a criminal prosecution for violating it, it's treated the same way as any other criminal statute, strictly construed against the state, liberally construed against the defendant, against this, liberally construed in favor of the defendant. So since this, and we could get in the odd situation where the statute strictly construed goes to the defendant, so there's no criminal penalties. But that's what this court has said.
Thank you.
Mr. Hardwick, let me just quickly ask you to address the culpability states in Ohio as a purposeful act, and your argument being the culpability state in the Texas statute as a knowledge element.
Correct.
Did I understand that correctly?
Correct.
The committee comment to 290101 on culpable mental states in a revised code says, although the section provides that proof of any degree of culpable mental state is sufficient to prove all lesser degrees, that is, proof of purpose is also proof of knowledge and recklessness and negligence. How does that statement comport with your argument?
Because this is the other way. Proof of knowledge does not indicate proof of purposefulness. And I do, it's important to note that we are looking at the statute here. We do not look in the, it does not matter what the indictment says. It does not matter what the jury instruction says. It does not matter any of the other facts of the case. We look at the elements only. It doesn't matter if the state can prove exactly what happened, fit Ohio's definition. The elements of the statute are what matter. And that's why this court should vacate Mr. Lloyd's sentence and discharge him, or in the alternative, send this case back for resentencing on an F-4.
Thank you. The matter will be taken under advisement, and you'll be notified of our opinion. Marsha, would you call a recess, please?